From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On a cool Easter afternoon in 1939, world-renowned black contralto Marian Anderson mounted the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to sing. There were 75,000 people on the Washington Mall to hear her, both white and black. That afternoon, she performed an operatic aria, Schubert's Ave Maria, and Negro spirituals. But having been banned from performing at Washington's Constitution Hall because of her race, this was much more than just a concert. Anderson's legendary performance became a milestone in the nation's civil rights history. It transformed Marian Anderson from celebrated singer to celebrated icon. But Anderson never felt comfortable in the icon role or as a pioneer for civil rights. In her own view, she was, above all, a singer. And what a singer! The conductor Arturo Toscanini told Marian Anderson, "A voice like yours is heard only once in 100 years. Her deep, soulful contralto neared a 3-octave range. Her dignified stage presence pierced the hearts of music lovers worldwide. Her talent flew her over the color line. She was the first black singer to perform at the White House and to sing with the Metropolitan Opera. Tonight, separating the icon from the musician, the music and voice of Marian Anderson. Joining me in the studio is Alan Kyler, professor of music at Brandeis University and author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey. Welcome, Alan Kyler.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Alan Kyler, we've seen the snapshot, we've seen the film clips, but paint that morning for us. What was the setting and what was the backdrop that brought Marian Anderson to that point?
Well, it began in the most routine way. Sol Yurok, Anderson's manager, requested the use of Constitution Hall from the DAR
for Daughters of the American Revolution.
Daughters of the American Revolution for a concert in Constitution Hall. It was the only possible concert hall for her, given the size of the audience that was expected. Mm-hmm. And the DAR refused. There were weeks and weeks of negotiations. Hurock and then officials from the NAACP and from Howard University tried to force the issue, but the DAR refused, even met, and I think with only one vote against, decided that they would not allow her to sing on the stage of Constitution Hall.
And it was openly because of her race.
Yes. As a matter of fact, every contract issued by the hall had typed in the center of it, white artists only, from almost the opening of the hall. A year or two after the hall, that policy was established.
And so she was, at the last minute, moved to the mall, or this was just found to be the only place in Washington for the crowd and the talent?
The controversy continued. Went to the Washington School Board. The board was asked to allow Anderson to use the White High School Auditorium of Central High School. It was the biggest high school auditorium. White high school auditoriums, of course, were much bigger than black high school auditoriums. Mm-hmm. And the Washington School Board, in the end, refused. At least put so many demands on allowing her that they thought that it was simply impossible to accept. And then it was Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, not Eleanor Roosevelt, whose idea it was to have a concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He brought the idea to Harold Ickes, the secretary of the Interior. Ickes brought it to President Roosevelt.
Harold Ickes, who was the grandfather of the Harold Ickes who worked for Bill Clinton.
Yeah,
right.
Father, actually.
Father, all right.
Ickes brought it to Roosevelt. Roosevelt said, absolutely. And permission was given to use the Lincoln Memorial.
And so that afternoon happened.
This happened after months of negotiation.
was there a buildup of anticipation because of this in the newspapers? Was it followed as a public issue? Was it part of the reason that 75,000 people ultimately attended, including Supreme Court members and congressmen?
That's right. For the first part of the negotiations, it was pretty much a local matter. Things changed when Eleanor Roosevelt resigned from the DAR
in protest, banning her.
Yes, in her column. When that took place, it became a national cause.
Marian Anderson was and is, to her chagrin, ever after known for that performance.
Yes.
But she didn't appear out of nowhere, as much as it may seem that way to those of us who just know that snapshot or that film clip. And she didn't disappear from that day on. Where did Mary Nedderson come from?
She was born. She was one of three sisters. She was born in South Philadelphia, in a very diverse neighborhood ethnically. Her parents were not very rich. Her family was struggled to give her a proper education, particularly. She had to wait 3 or 4 years before she could continue school and go on to high school, simply because the family had no money, and because by that time they were depending on the money that she earned as a singer.
She comes across as black aristocracy.
Well, she has a kind of regal quality.
Mm-hmm. But was she, in fact, socially from that class or caste?
Not at all. Her parents were freed slaves, came from Virginia. Family was poor.
How was her singing talent discovered?
In church, as the case for many black singers. She sang in church from the age of 6, and it was clear from the very beginning that she was extraordinarily gifted. She was a contralto, which is unusual for a girl of that age, already to have that kind of lower voice, but she could sing any part in the chorus. If the soprano soloist didn't show up one Sunday afternoon, she always hoped that the soprano soloist would not show up, then she would sing the soprano aria. This enormous, not two things, this enormous range that she had already as a young girl and this determination to perform.
When was she born?
1897.
So by 1939, she was well into a career already.
That's right. She was well into the famous part of her career.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, she struggled as a concert artist in this country, getting pretty much nowhere.
Formal training?
She never attended a conservatory or music school. She wanted desperately to. There's, of course, the famous story when she was turned away when she applied for application form at a music conservatory near her house. The person at the desk said, "We don't take blacks." Mm. But she was taught by a number of very good vocal teachers from the time that she was in high school, especially Giuseppe Bugatti, who worked very hard with her and whom she credited a great deal for the education she received from him. And then, of course, when she went on to study in Europe, as every artist, not only black artists, as every mm-hmm. artist was expected to do, was born in this country, mm-hmm. she then studied with a number of important teachers in Europe, particularly with German teachers, because she wanted so desperately to master German leader.
Alan Kiley, you've written a wonderful biography of Mary Nedderson. Paint the picture for us of what, I guess, first of all, what was the concert scene at that time? How did Marian Anderson fall in it? You said she struggled to get bookings, but
that's right.
The history almost requires that we do some mental archaeology here to relate both to what a singer's career or life was typically like in those days and, if you will, to the very sound of this music. It's starting to sound very almost archaic in that, that high, tremulous voice. It brings back a very distant era. What was the sound that was most celebrated, and how did she bring it to life?
Well, her career started in the 20s, and for black singers in the 20s, there were few possibilities for performing. They could sing in black churches and black universities and colleges in the South, for example. And apart from those, they were pretty much limited to perhaps Philadelphia and New York. Mm-hmm. But it was very unlikely that they would be managed by any important concert manager who had no experience with managing black singers. And so she followed Roland Hayes, who was kind of mentor, a black singer about 10 years younger. She followed the same route as he did, singing in the South in black colleges and universities.
And her repertoire? Was it the same repertoire that a white singer would exercise?
With one exception. Her repertoire included the full spectrum of art songs, songs in German by Schubert, by Schumann, mm-hmm. French songs, chansons or mélodies as they're called, mm-hmm. songs in English by American composers, the groups of songs that white concert singers sang, as well as the few black singers who preceded her, Roland Hayes, for example, but they included Negro spirituals. She was one of the first singers to sing so-called concert Negro spirituals. They didn't really exist for the concert singer before the First World War.
Let's
they were arranged around that time for the first time for performance on the concert stage.
Let's get a sense of that from 1924, relatively early in her career, before her European period. Here's Go Down Moses. Marian Anderson singing Go Down Moses in 1924. Alan Kyler, take us through the scratchiness of the recording and the what now sounds like the formality of the delivery. And talk to us about the emotional impact of Marian Anderson singing on her audiences in that day.
Well, I think one thing that's important is the change that came over her audiences when she got at the very end of each program to Negro spiritual. She always waited until the end of the program and then sang a group of Negro spirituals. And many people thought that only at that point did she reveal much of her character and personality.
She was technique until then.
It was more art song that required a specialized kind of knowledge and training. Mm-hmm. But by the time she got to the group of spirituals, they felt that she had come closer to the audience, that she had revealed her character and personality. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they could identify. Mm-hmm. Many of her audiences during those years were entirely black audiences. They were segregated. Mm-hmm. They could identify with the struggle and the pain and the sorrow expressed in these black melodies.
And how did they respond to the almost art song presentation of the spiritual? You know, later we're accustomed to a much more informal, casual, earthy rendition
of spirituals.
That's
right, gospel, for example.
Mm-hmm. Was this seen as elevating a native art form, or was it seen as distant?
Well, I think it depended on the singer, probably. In the case of Anderson, it was a question of bringing her closer to the audience. Many people felt. And it also had to do with the style of singing. You're right when you say that for Anderson, her performances of Negro spirituals tended to be more art song-like than someone like Paul Robeson, who was less art song about it, who seemed more popular, more open, more folk-like. And that was probably part of Marian Anderson's character. It's the way she was.
We'll come back and talk about how Marian Anderson walked and crossed the line between formal song, art song, and Negro spiritual. We're talking with Alan Kyler, author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey, about the great black contralto, Marian Anderson. We're listening here in the background to Finnish folk song. We'll come back and hear more about it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Back up, 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 back up
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Marian Anderson, the great black contralto who became a civil rights icon almost against her will. Here's a 1936 recording from the CD Marian Anderson Rare and Unpublished Recordings. It's a Sibelius song recorded in Paris, Fardet in Drôme. Marian Anderson's Fardet in Drôme. We're joined tonight by Alan Kyler, author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey, a biography of the great singer. And Alan Kyler, here we've gone from the earlier 1924, Godon Moses, and a dozen years later, Marian Anderson is recording in Paris. She's deep into the European repertoire. Before we talk about the music, what took her from the United States to Europe?
Well, she felt like every singer, not just a black singer, but like any American singer, that in order to really have a career of importance in this country, you have to go to Europe. Somehow you need a stamp of approval. You need to be trained in Europe, and you certainly need to win great notices, good notices in Paris and London. Simply, it was part of the old insecure snobbishness, perhaps, of American audiences.
Still looking back across the pond.
Still looking back across the pond for that kind of imprimatur, you know. And in Anderson's case, her career was particularly at a standstill. The Depression era had set in. There were fewer and fewer bookings. She felt that a change was really important and that she would have to go to Europe. And besides, she wanted to get closer to the actual language, German.
That she was singing in. What year did she go?
So she finally, for the very first time, went in 1928 to London and spent a year there studying.
How did she accomplish that? Was she sponsored by someone? Did she have the bookings that paid for it?
She had a Rosenwald Fellowship to study in Europe, which gave her enough money to spend a year there. And she studied most of the time. She gave very few concerts. Things were not that much better. She tried again. In 1930, she went to Berlin, I think, and that was the difference, because now it was Germany. Now she could work with a German teacher. Now she could live with a German family.
And why did that make all the difference?
Because she wanted to learn German, not simply to sing in German. She wanted to know the language, to feel it, to understand it.
She
to
loved
understand the culture and the music. She wanted to get close to it. And the way you do it for a singer is to go to the country of that music and to study.
Marian Anderson loved German Lieder, German, German song. What was it about that vein of song that was so compelling to her?
Well, a number of things, I suppose. She was very drawn to that music from Roland Hayes. Roland Hayes had always included German Lieder on his concert programs, and it was that group of songs particularly that she liked. But, of course, that's not the only answer. I think any singer would agree that the German art song of the 19th century is the most challenging, is the most complex, the nuance, the detail, the psychological complexity of the song. It's so rich, so many-leveled in its significance, and it's melodically so strong and vivid, and that was always important to Anderson. So the music of Schubert and Schumann would inevitably be the music that she was drawn to. Melodist Schubert.
Was she alone in her passion for German Lieder, or was this the song, the brand of song everyone wanted to be singing?
It was the most challenging, the most central repertoire for an art singer, for a recitalist.
What was her life like in Berlin in the 30s as a black American singer?
Well, of course, Germany was much more open to blacks between the war. Things got a little more difficult, as you know, in 33. But in 30,
the
things
Nazi
were
party
okay.
Began to make its inroads.
That's right. But in the first year, things were okay. She was nervous. There are some letters in which she told her mother about what was going to happen and that she was nervous and anxious about it. But generally, she was treated well. She lived with a wonderful German family. She studied with several teachers simultaneously, and she made her debut in Germany in the Bachsaal and singing German Lieder. And it was an extraordinary success and something that they had never seen before. Roland Hayes had sung in Germany before and was not greeted well when he came to the group of German songs. He had to disarm the audience before they would allow a black singer to sing that repertoire. With Anderson, apparently, they needed no disarming. They accepted her immediately.
And the notices?
Fantastic notices. A friend of Brahms came to hear one of those concerts. She had sung a group of songs by Brahms that she had learned very recently. This friend of Brahms said he had never heard anything like it in his entire life. That was the four serious songs of Brahms.
When you read those German reviews, the Berlin reviews from the 30s of a black American, Marian Anderson, do you read unalloyed praise, or is there an element of racism here? Ah, black singer.
Yes, there's an element of racism. There's some flowery introduction about the daughter of the Nile and her color, of course, something that you would, of course, expect. But it you know, ended very quickly, and the rest of the notices were about this extraordinary ability she had to understand and to sing in the most appropriate way stylistically this repertoire, which of course was strange, was unusual to them. They had no experience of a singer of that kind, a black singer who seemed to have mastered the language and the stylistic variety of the music as well as she had.
Let's listen to Der Tod und das Mädchen, Death and the Maiden. This is from the CD Marian Anderson, Schubert and Schumann Lieder. Before we listen, tell us a little bit about this, and what are we listening for here?
Well, it's a very celebrated song by Schubert. Every low singer sings it because it ends on a low D. You'll hear the last note, which you think is probably sung by a man rather than Anderson. It's pretty extraordinary. It's not just the lower note, but it's the kind of quality that she gave to that D in order
that
to suggest kind of all-embracing peacefulness that is suggested in the song. The song, and she has to impersonate two characters, the maiden, who says, "Pass by, go away, you fierce bone. I'm still young, and do not touch me." And
speaking to death.
Speaking to death. And death responds, "Give me your hand, you pretty tender thing. I'm a friend, and don't come to hurt you."
Marian Anderson, Death and the Maiden. The low note Marian Anderson hits in Death and the Maiden. As you say, Alan Kyler, it almost sounds like a man's voice is coming in to pick up that deep bottom.
She was a true contralto. She had that low range, and it was full.
And the mood, the emotion that she conveys, were the Germans responding to that? Was it something different to them? Did they hear the resonance of a different culture within the form of their own language and their own song?
No, I don't think so. I think that they were amazed at how accurate her perception of Schubert's music is, how stylistically appropriate it was, how well she understood the text and what Schubert demanded. The other thing which I think has been pointed out, and certainly was then, which is very important, particularly to me, there's a difference between singing in a foreign language accurately and singing not only accurately but idiomatically. Mm-hmm. When you hear someone like Janet Baker sing, for example, German or French, it's extremely accurate. But when you hear Marian Anderson sing, it's not only accurate, it sounds that she was a native speaker. Mm. You have the illusion that she's a native speaker of whatever language she sings in.
All the meaning seems packed in the bags there.
Yes, it sounds like she sounds like the language is hers. It's not just school learned and accurate. But it sounds natural and idiomatic.
But let's compare Death and the Maiden with Liebesbotschaft. Here's a much more... This is not low. This gets up into the soprano range.
That's right. Here you would think that she was a mezzo-soprano, even a soprano. You hear her upper range. It's a joyful song about love and love's message as it's carried by the brook.
We hear the brook already.
You hear the brook already.
Liebesbotschaft, Marian Anderson singing. Ellen Kyler, what's she singing about?
She's singing about a rustling brook, so silvery and bright, as it carries the message of her beloved to her beloved.
And as she's singing here, she's also approaching the time when she'll leave Europe and come back to the United States. What was turning her thoughts homeward?
She came back to the States in 1935. After singing hundreds of concerts throughout Europe. Sal Hurok, the most famous and important American manager, heard her sing in Paris and decided to give her a contract. She came back, in other words, a Hurok artist.
Mm-hmm. Which at that time was about the best it could
right.
be.
A Hurok artist meant the world. He was Arthur Rubinstein's manager, mm-hmm. as he was countless other artists. And she was, of course, the first black artist that Hurok managed. And under Hurok's aegis, she became one of the most well-loved and important American singers in a very small number of years.
By 1938, she was
Absolutely.
Giving 70 recitals
70
a year.
70 recitals a year in this country alone. And here I could boast to the press, and he did in 1938, about how much money she made, or how much money they both made for her recitals. She earned a great deal of money in 1938.
Sang in the White House in 1938.
She sang in the White House.
For whom? What event?
For the Roosevelts.
They were entertaining?
They were entertaining guests, I believe. There were other people at the same time. She was one of the guests who was asked to sing. It's interesting that they wanted her to sing only Negro spirituals, and she said, no, I'm not going to sing only Negro spirituals. She sang some, but she also sang Schubert.
Good for her. Good for her. Do you know what
she was this business of being typecast. I'm a black singer, and therefore
right.
I sing Negro spirituals. She hated that.
So she was very aware of the racial issue. What did it feel like coming back from relatively cosmopolitan Europe mm-hmm. to the good old USA, where racism was very much still alive and kicking?
Well, it was Hurok who broke down those barriers for her. He said, if you want to have Yasha Heifetz on mm-hmm. your concert program for the season, you have to have Marian Anderson. If you don't take Marian Anderson, you don't get Yasha Heifetz. He would do anything. Hurok had a great deal of power and a great deal of imagination. And in only a small number of years, he saw that she sang virtually all over the country. The South was still a problem.
Did she go to the South at all?
She did, but she was very conservative about those things as compared to other black artists.
Mm-hmm.
She believed that you take things slowly and that you accomplish things through education.
And go where you're invited.
Go where
welcome.
You're invited and that you don't stir up trouble. She said, I'm not made for hand-to-hand combat.
Was Hurok's embrace enough to spare her from racial indignities?
Yeah, she was given very soon traveling companion who would, Joffe was his name, who adored her. He was a Russian Jew who accompanied her, who made sure that there would be no problems in hotels and restaurants. But even so, everybody who knew her during those years and who worked with her as an artist observed how she was treated. She would be asked to go up in her hotel in the elevator that the luggage was taken up. In Canada, even as late as the 40s or 50s, I believe, as late as the 50s, she was accepted by a hotel in Toronto, but when she sang in the lobby, they put a screen around her.
A screen around her?
Yes.
So you heard the voice but didn't
no,
see?
No, in the lobby, when she was sitting down in the lobby. They allowed her to have a room in the hotel.
I see.
They accepted her as a guest, but when she sat in the lobby, they put a screen around her.
Simply to block
yeah, so
the view of this black woman who was this magnificent singer sitting in the
what
lobby.
What would the white guests think if they saw that a black
Then let me, you see in the photographs in your book a very elegant woman draped and dressed to a T.
Yes, she learned very quickly how important it was, what she said her appearance, that you needed to look smashing. She didn't say those words, I suppose, on the stage. It was hard at the start because she didn't have a lot of money and she had only a few gowns. But when she began to make more money, she liked clothes and jewelry.
and it shows in the photographs? It's all right there?
She spent a great deal of money on clothes and jewelry. But not only did she spend money on herself, she was incredibly generous to her whole family.
What did it feel like then, coming off this high, the great reviews in Europe, back to the States, embraced by Hurok, concerts everywhere, and suddenly the good old daughters of the American Revolution say no, just put it right in her face in 1939, only a year after she returned?
Well, she was a person who didn't believe in hatred and in blame. And therefore she, I think, put it out of her mind as best as she could. She didn't hold things against them. She didn't hold grudges, she said often. They were people who were educated a certain time and place and acted in the way they had to act or saw other people act. But they would learn eventually, hopefully, and be raised up. She believed that.
Well, and maybe she had a part in raising it up. Here's Ave Maria, one of the songs she sang on that Easter Sunday in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
She wrote Ave Maria.
It's Marian Anderson singing Schubert's Ave Maria. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Alan Kyler, author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey, about the great black contralto. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Marian Anderson, the great black contralto who became a civil rights icon almost against her will. Here she is singing in the song with which she broke the color line at the Metropolitan Opera, Verdi's Un ballo in maschera. Marian Anderson's small role of Ulrika in Verdi's Un ballo in maschera, 1955, first black singer at the Metropolitan Opera. I'm joined tonight by Alan Kyler, author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey. Alan Kyler, what was her reception? 1955, we're really moving into the civil rights era now. How was she taken by the New York audience?
Well, the choice of Anderson, I think, was a choice of conscience. She was nearly 60 years old when she made her debut. Nobody in their right mind makes a debut at the age of 60 and never having sung an opera before. Mm-hmm. But Rudolf Bing, manager, head of the Metropolitan Opera, the artistic director, wanted to break the collar line in a way that would not upset the Board of Trustees and would not bring too much controversy.
Let me ask about that. Are you saying that even at the Met in New York in 1955,
right,
race was that big an issue?
That's
that
right.
The Daughters of the American Revolution problem was still dogging
yes,
her?
Yes, that's right.
That is incredible.
They had been trying for several years to find a way to hire a singer who they believed in, but also to find a way to avoid controversy, mm-hmm, being never told the board. This was a very late decision. And, of course, he felt that nobody could object to Marian Anderson. She was too important, too popular, too much a symbol. Mm-hmm. What better way to break the collar line and to avoid controversy? And so she was asked to fulfill the, I think, rather difficult role and to make her debut at that age. She was, of course, nervous and frightened. She sings only in the second scene of the opera, and at the beginning, the curtain wouldn't rise. There was some kind of mechanical failure, and the audience grew more and more restless. She became more and more nervous. Finally, the curtain rose. There was an amazing ovation for her.
So there was an understanding in that audience.
Yes.
Maybe an understanding much more deeply felt in 1955 than today of who this was and what
she
meant.
Yes. I don't think it mattered much how she performed. It was Marian Anderson, who was long since due at the Metropolitan. It was an outpouring of love, sympathy. The critics were mixed.
But Marian Anderson was there and the line was crossed.
Right.
She went on. Singh lived a long life, died in her 90s.
Died at the age of 95.
Sang at President Kennedy's inaugural in 1961.
Right, Eisenhower's inauguration, Kennedy's inauguration. Yes. I mean, she went on to sing after this until 1965. She had almost a decade more as a concert artist.
Still kept the spirituals all the way through. Let's hear a little bit as we talk of There's No Hiding Place.
My face to rock right out, no hiding place, no hiding place down there. Oh, to rock right, I'm burning.
All right, Ellen Kyler, as she came to the end of her life and she looked back, all that singing, all those concerts, all that talent, and that one day in 1939 when she sang on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, how did it all stack up in her mind? Was that the most important moment, or how did she remember it?
She probably had long forgotten the Lincoln Memorial concert, and if she didn't forget, it was not terribly important to her. What was important is that she made it possible for black singers to sing at the Met. That was important. That after her came Leontine Price and Grace Bunbury and a host of other singers. That meant a great deal. In her bedroom, where she lived in the last year of her life in Portland, when she lived with her nephew, James the Priest, a very famous conductor, is a picture of Leontine Price, Grace Bunbury, and Shirley Verrett. Oh,
and she had cleared the way for all of them.
Yes, that's what meant something to her. Also what meant something to her is her mastery of a huge variety of styles, which she worked on her whole life. That she could sing Schubert and Fauré and Sibelius and Villa-Lobos in the languages of the composer.
Hard to honor everything that she represents, all that mastery. But at the same time, those images from that Easter day in 1939, incredibly important. It has the visual impact of the seedbed of the civil rights movement.
Right. They're larger than she is.
they are. American history pulls us all in, and especially a talent like hers. Ellen Kyler, it's been great talking to you tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for sharing so much of what we don't know behind the snapshot and the film clips of that day. Ellen Kyler is professor at Brandeis University and author of Marian Anderson, A Singer's Journey. I'm going to go out listening to a song that I sure was raised with all the time. He's got the whole world in his hands from the CD. He's got the whole world in his hands spirituals with pianist Franz Rupp, Marian Anderson.
He's got little bits of baby in his hands. He's got little bits of baby in his hands.
You can join the Marian Anderson conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums.
He's got the whole world in his hands.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We look forward to an open dialogue with Congress and the American people about the threat. And that not only will we consult with the United States Congress, we being the administration, but that my administration will fully participate in any hearings that the Congress wishes to have on this subject.
The special ceremony meeting will be in order.
They did not understand the true strength of America is not steel. It is not concrete. It is our belief in the ideals enshrined in our Constitution and in our Bill of Rights.
The president was got into the car, going towards the shrine nearby, when a uniformed person opened fire just in front of the car. A bodyguard of President Karzai opened fire on the assassin. That bodyguard was killed, and two or three other people have been wounded.
It also means changing the way we consume resources, particularly energy, and it means the world, the whole world, facing up to the challenge of climate change. Kyoto is right, and it should be ratified by all of us.
The United States is taking action to meet environmental challenges, including global climate change. We are committed. We are committed. We are committed. We are committed not just to rhetoric and to various goals. We are committed to a $1 billion program to develop and deploy advanced technologies to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions.
In a landmark decision, a special 9-judge panel unanimously ruled that 2 relatives of Palestinian terror suspects could be expelled from the West Bank to Gaza. The justices upheld the expulsions of the sister and brother of a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. The court said that expulsions can only be carried out on people who present a real security threat.
This is a sad day for human rights. This is a black day for international law. The Palestinian Authority will go to the Security Council, will go to the International Court of Justice, will seek the help of all those interested in preserving the human rights and the 4th Geneva Conventions worldwide, because this is a very dangerous precedent.
The system, the organization is dispersed, and in some ways it is dysfunctional. It needs to become coherent and consolidated, coordinated to rise to the complex challenge of defeating 21st century terrorism in our homeland.
And there's a week President Bush meets with congressional leaders on war with Iraq. Special congressional session held today in New York City. Tom Daschle speaks on American ideals. Afghan President Hamid Karzai narrowly survives an assassination attempt in Kandahar. Tony Blair calling on all nations to sign the Kyoto Treaty on Global Warming at the Earth Summit in Johannesburg. Colin Powell being heckled at that summit. Israel Supreme Court giving Israel approval to expel family members of terror suspects from the West Bank to Gaza. Palestinians condemn those expulsions, and Senator Joe Lieberman in the Senate debate on the Homeland Security Bill still unpassed. Jack Beatty, we can feel the momentum moving now again on the war with Iraq after several weeks of wavering and indecision.
Yes, and it's interesting to compare this week with last week. Last week, Dick Cheney, the vice president, made a speech in which he seemed to say, which he out and said, that the whole idea of putting inspectors into Iraq, that was just a non-starter, that it was a delusion, that people who thought that were kidding themselves, and there was no point in going any further on that. Well, according to Newsweek magazine, he didn't clear that with the president. He was being unilateral as against against the president. And but maybe it was a trial balloon. But clearly in the week since, and also last week, I believe the White House counsel the week before said that the president didn't need congressional authority. Well, now I think there's been a switch on both fronts. It looks like they're definitely going to go before Congress. There are going to be lots of hearings, lots of talk. And the president's giving a speech at the U.N., and he may well ask for another resolution from the U.N., and it may be a kind of around the issue of inspections, perhaps even a kind of ultimatum around inspections. Because when Cheney kicked away the inspection idea, he kicked away what the British government was using as the casus belli. If they don't admit inspectors, if they interfere with that, we have a reason for war. Cheney was saying, oh, let's not even bother with that.
But, Jack, you know, even as we talk about consulting Congress and going before the UN and maybe having inspections, somehow the momentum toward war seems to be heightening, not diminishing.
Oh, yeah, I think so. It just may be moving in more collective ways. I mean, I think Tony Blair is going to be here this weekend, and his whole government, as I say, is strongly around the notion of trying to get the inspectors back in. I think he's going to just say to the president, we'll be with you if you do this, if you at least, and don't just go through the motions, make an offer that isn't going to seem to them completely onerous. Who knows? Who knows how Saddam Hussein processes reality? I mean, you know, he's a megalomaniac. People don't tell him if it's raining out for fear that he'll be offended.
Plenty of reminders this week of how fragile things can be on the other side of a military strike. Afghanistan coming very close to losing Hamid Karzai.
Yeah, and you know, for months, experts on our program have been saying it's a mistake not to expand the Allied protection force beyond Kabul, that the country is in danger of falling apart, warlords, terrorism, and so on. And Secretary Rumsfeld has said, no, I don't. Not only will the United States not do that, we don't want the Allies to do it. Well, now there's been a switch. They're accommodating to reality, and they say, yeah, we've got to get more boots on the ground, but it's going to be European boots. And this represents a switch, a change of view on the part of Mr. Rumsfeld, who wasn't known for changing his views.
All a clear reminder of what nation building can cost and entail post a military strike.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. And now the Pentagon's saying we may be there for years. We may be there for years. This is a prelude to Iraq.
Just little Afghanistan. Wait, Iraq. Jack, yeah. Have a great weekend.
And you too.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris Bonacci, Zach Christo, and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're